And what's interesting about that, and why it's important that we win this race to do this, has really strong effects of what economists call winner takes all. You know, if you move first in technology, if you become the biggest player quickly in, you know, like Silicon Valley did, then there's a strong tendency to remain at the top. So it's quite important to start winning. You know, the winner takes all. People want to be in the tech ecosystem that's the biggest.
Hello, and welcome to the Brentis Foundation podcast. I'm your host, Marina Wangokolo, and it's a pleasure to be here with you today. I hope everyone is doing excellently well. Is that even English? Let's just go with it. All right, this is the Brentis Foundation podcast, where I interview the best and brightest on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I've had some really interesting conversations with really cool people, and I want to share them with you. And my hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations on your side and lead to the generation of ideas that work, the ideas that make a difference. Again, I'm Marina Wangokolo, and you're listening to the Brentis Foundation podcast. So today, services constitute the largest sector in the global economy, accounting for 70% of global GDP, 60% of global employment, and some 46% of global exports measured in value-added terms. We cannot understate the role of services. Thanks to COVID-19, we've seen also a major acceleration of tech in supporting lives and livelihoods, especially during lockdown, and even more so in a COVID-19 adjusted world. On today's episode, I'll be speaking with Tim Harris. Tim Harris is with Consulum, a PR and advisory firm based out of Cape Town. In his previous life, Tim was the CEO of Westgrow, where he made significant contributions to driving growth in tourism, trade, and investment in the Western Cape of South Africa. He'll be speaking about technology and BPO services, business process outsourcing services, in South Africa, and whether South Africa is poised to take full advantage of the increased digitalization and surge in tradable services. Without further ado, let's get straight into the chat with Tim Harris. Tim, welcome. It's good to have you here. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
I am very well, thank you. All right, so to get us warmed up, I thought we could engage in a very quick game to familiarize ourselves and the audience with who you are. Are you ready?
Right.
Okay. What was your first job on your resume?
Well, it's not on my resume. My first job, I delivered pizza for Debonairs.
Wow. Do you have any hobbies or skills that people don't know about?
I mean, I love to surf. Maybe some people don't know that.
Really, I'm one of those. All right. So what best describes your workday?
What best describes my workday is working all over the world from right here in Cape Town.
Wow, amazing. Amazing. Are you a zero inbox person, Tim?
No, I'm the opposite.
How do you keep order? Goodness.
I don't.
All right. So, Tim, what would you say is the one skill that maybe you underestimated but has served you like really well in your career?
Writing.
Ooh, how did you get better at writing?
Well, I used to love reading, so I decided to study English. And it turns out, as well as reading a lot of books when you study English, you have to write a lot of essays. And it's amazing how much of any job is about verbal and written communication. So it turned out to be, even though it's not known as a kind of business qualification, the UCT English department, I think, made a big impact on my ability to be more effective at work.
Mm, excellent. Definitely, I can speak to that. What was the last aha moment you had, and what was it about?
I mean, I think it's probably the sense that tourists are starting to come back to South Africa and starting to come back to Cape Town. You know, we've been expecting it, but there's something about seeing the Germans and the Scandinavians walking around the city with their big cameras, I feel like going to give them a hug. Because to me, it kind of signals that we're back, and all of the international business that we used to do will come back, and we're going to be okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. That's excellent. Right. Tim, what comes to mind when you think about or when you hear Africa in 2050?
Africa in 2050. I mean, by then, it's going to be one of the world's largest regional markets. And I've spent probably most of the last 15 years trying to get people around the world to understand the demography that underpins that and the huge business opportunity that that represents. So I just think of kind of demographically driven market size and that as a force for positive change on the continent.
So I take it you are optimistic, not pessimistic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This continent has things that are increasingly scarce in the rest of the world. And the two most important ones, or three most important ones, number one is wild spaces. We forget how much of that has gone in the developed world and how much we still have here in Africa and how much we need to preserve it as something that as it becomes even scarcer globally, becomes more and more valuable for us. The second is youth. The rest of the world is aging, and Africa definitely isn't. And so that becomes eventually a major advantage for the continent, having that young population, but also particularly young workforce. And then thirdly, I think a kind of sense of optimism and possibility. Sometimes we need reminding of it, but when people, often when people visit Africa from abroad, they feel like there's opportunity everywhere. And we sometimes need to remind ourselves of that in Africa, because the developed markets are really closed in that respect. And a lot of opportunities already been taken, which narrows the space to do new things. And when people come with fresh eyes, they often realize just how much opportunity there still is on our continent.
Hear, hear. Thank you so much, Tim, for indulging. That was definitely fun, and I hope more insightful. I, for one, know Tim surfs, so hopefully other people learned other things as well. All right, so let's get straight into the episode. So, Tim, we've heard on several occasions, right, that, you know, COVID-19 pandemic has dramatically sort of accelerated the use of technology or even technology adoption in the world at large, but also on the continent as well. Can you help us sort of understand, like, where this acceleration is occurring on the continent, which areas, and what that means for employment and job creation opportunities?
So the main argument I'm making in this chapter is that what you're describing, the kind of work from home revolution that swept every business in every country, is accelerating a shift to the globalization of services that began with things like business process outsourcing, but is rapidly incorporating many more types of work beyond service operations, and is essentially being driven by the same dynamic that is driving technological change in our economies, and that the world of the tech economy, which is now, you know, responsible for the largest companies on earth, and this idea that increasingly work can be done in a distributed way and outsourced using digital technology to places that represent much better value, is that those two ideas are merging, and they both represent a significant opportunity for Africa and particularly South Africa.
And I know even with sort of, you know, tech, where everybody's trying to embrace tech and the jobs that it's creating, like the ability for somebody sitting in South Africa to be working, you know, with or for some companies sitting elsewhere, you know, the UK, France, basically anywhere, right? But it's also a lot in the media, especially on the continent and by academics, about sort of the gig economy around the kinds of jobs that tech is creating, and also the dangers of that with like lack of job security, and potentially maybe lower wages, because, you know, people are not necessarily at the managerial or the higher levels, or they don't necessarily have the what's called like intellectual rights and things stored on the continent. What are your thoughts on sort of the role of tech in creating, you know, decent work or decent jobs for people? And how do we even ensure that, you know, these jobs aren't, they don't put people in that, you know, slightly insecure or middle ground place where it's like, oh, we only have a job for a few months, but you never know if something is going to come. Like, is that something that we can manage? And if it is, how do we go about that? And if it's not as well, like, what does that mean?
So I think the best analogy is you can imagine if we were doing a podcast like this, you know, hypothetically 100 years ago, when people, you know, got a career and they stayed in that career their whole life. Maybe they would look at the way we work now, where people have multiple phases to their career, where they switch jobs. They would probably look at that as a sort of deeply insecure and unsettling situation. But I think almost everybody who works the way we do now, switching from career to career, employer to employer, over the course of their lives, would say that it's a lot better than joining a firm when you're 19 and getting a gold watch when you leave at 65. So partly the answer to that question is just a kind of sense of perspective. I think, you know, the gig economy and the this kind of almost contract-driven world, where we all will probably eventually become service providers that are fulfilling gigs or fulfilling shorter-term contracts and then moving on to the next one. I think partly it's just our perspective that makes that seem less secure relative to the two or three or four jobs that most people right now will have in their lives. So I'm not sure it's necessarily a bad thing for that in that new flexibility. I also think partly it's unavoidable. This is the impact that technology is having on economics. It's turning more and more things into services that are tradable. And I'm not denying that there are potential downsides linked to that kind of work, but overall, if you look at the youth bulge in Africa and the huge requirement to create jobs for young people, this is absolutely a net positive, provided we can get some of the policy pieces right that we'll talk about later, to make sure that young South Africans and young Africans are eligible to do more of this global work from right here in Africa. And the best sort of insight from the developed world that I read in the last few months was a writer called Sarah O'Connor writing in the Financial Times from the US-UK perspective, saying this year's mass experiment with remote working has for some triggered a prickling sense of unease. If I can do my job from home in London, Brooklyn, or Canberra, could someone else do it more cheaply from Sofia, Mumbai, or Manila? And I think, you know, if you're sitting from the other side of the Atlantic, this looks like a big risk, right? They talk in the US about offshoring of jobs. But of course, if you're sitting on our side of the Atlantic, it seems like an opportunity. And the question is, how can we capture that opportunity?
No, that's definitely amazing and helpful. And I think one of the things you mentioned, which we definitely will get to, actually, I think maybe we can talk about right now. What are some of those, like, you know, policy or sort of reforms, interventions that would help address this issue and help to sort of unlock like the creation of jobs in the tech space in South Africa or even on the continent at large?
Yeah, so I think they come down to kind of three areas. The one is making sure that you have the know-how and the skill sets in your economy to actually do these jobs. So it's in the kind of education, skilled immigration, know-how space. And we'll talk later about detailed policies for South Africa, but I don't think any country with a young workforce able to do remote work, whether it's working in call centers or becoming a tech developer, you can't get into the game unless you are increasing the average skill levels in your country to a point where your labor market becomes competitive for those jobs. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. Then secondly, you need infrastructure to make sure that people can connect to this work. So one of the things a lot of workplaces, including the one I was running during COVID, we experienced was remote work was great for those people that had fiber connections and had webcams and laptops and multiple screens and were able to connect and start doing their work. Yeah. In some cases more easily than if they were sitting in an office. But there were a whole lot of people in the workplace I was running that didn't have that. We had to work really hard to get hardware into people's hands. We needed to distribute a lot of mobile hotspots. You realize the hard connectivity issues that people still face in communities across South Africa. And then even if you can get hardware and internet connections to them, there's also a kind of social issues around being able to work from home. If people are living in a very small household where everybody's sharing the same living space, how do you conduct multiple Zoom calls even if you have the hardware? So it was to me, it kind of emphasized this whole area of our economies making sure that we have the minimum infrastructure and connectivity to get into the game of globalized work. And then thirdly is the kind of what you might call the sort of regulatory environment, the kind of the business environment and ease of doing business in your country just becomes even more important as competition grows. So basically the barriers to competing for these jobs has become lower. So more countries can get into the game. If they ensuring they have the skill and education levels, if they're ensuring they have the infrastructure and connectivity, then you really need your business environment to keep up in terms of the reform agenda to make sure that you remain competitive. And you just have to look at countries like the Philippines and India that have managed to turn some of these trends in previous years into relatively easy jobs for millions of their citizens. The question is for other developing countries like South Africa that are just getting into this game, how quickly can we get the educational reforms, roll out the infrastructure and improve the business environment so that we can bring some of those millions of jobs that are going to emerge over the next few years here?
No, that's amazing. And I think, you know, the points you raise are super important. And it's one of the things I hear quite often. But Tim, I wanted to ask from your point of view, from your experience or perspective, how can we start to practically address some of these things, right? So for instance, let's think about the knowledge or the skills required, right, to compete with others, even in their quote unquote, the North or global West. This is something that is happening now. And I'm not too sure how that fits with even traditional education systems. So if that was something, for instance, that you were in charge of and you're like, okay, we're trying to compete with these guys, how would you practically address that in, you know, the next 12 to 18 months? Like, what are some of the things that you start doing to ensure that people have or can build or acquire those skills in a pretty short period of time? And even addressing the issue of infrastructure and the cost of that, like, how would you start to address something like that?
So firstly, I don't think we are competing with the developed world for these jobs. I think we're competing with other emerging world economies. That the jobs will be offshored. You know, they are like technologies turning more and more things into tradable services. So they are going to distribute more evenly around the world. The question is, how do we make sure that South Africa captures, you know, at least our fair share of that?
Right.
And so the competition, in a sense, is kind of with ourselves. And I don't think it's a sort of zero-sum game with the developed world. And the other thing that's happening is you know, I talk in the paper about frontier innovations, which is traditionally one of the areas that economists have identified as the sort of source of new business potential. So things like your universities, you know, or your institutions of higher learning or basic education system. There's been such an advantage in the developed world, you know, with the Ivy League and Oxbridge and these institutions that have become that have been their kind of competitive advantage over centuries. Essentially, one of the things that this globalization of services is doing is it means developing markets can kind of tap into those. So the example that I talk about is a tech startup, say in Bloemfontein, that is paying salaries in rands, but is incorporated as a Delaware company, which many tech companies are. So it's got a US incorporation. Maybe it's got a New York law firm that's one of the top regarded in the world. So investors are going to look at it very favorably as their legal advisors. And possibly they've raised money in Silicon Valley from a US VC. Essentially, those things, those attributes, being able to incorporate in Delaware, have a lawyer in New York and raise money in Silicon Valley, those were things that were reserved for American companies until this globalization started happening. Now, those frontier innovations are kind of available to companies all over the world. So it's not just about being able to create jobs that can service business in the rest of the world now. It's also about shifting that entrepreneurship and that sort of company level innovation into our markets, because we can now shortcut those what they call frontier innovations. And what's interesting about that, and why it's important that we win this race to do this, has really strong effects of what economists call winner takes all. You know, if you move first in technology, if you become the biggest player quickly in, you know, like Silicon Valley did, then there's a strong tendency to remain at the top. So it's quite important to start winning. You know, the winner takes all. People want to be in the tech ecosystem that's the biggest. And that applies globally, which explains Silicon Valley, but it also applies regionally, which explains, you know, Cape Town, Nairobi, Lagos. There's a battle on between these hubs to become number one in Africa, and being number one matters, right? But the great thing is, with that globalization, you no longer need to be number one globally. You can be number one regionally, and by tapping into that frontier innovation I mentioned, you can generate some of the returns that traditionally would have gone into Silicon Valley. And then the third area is this old idea in economics. When I studied economics 20 years ago, it was quite obvious that if you were going to develop as a country, you had to industrialize. It was every single country had done that. It was taken as a given that you needed to move from agriculture to higher value add industrial production in order to become a developed country. But I think now there's this fascinating potential for countries to develop without industrialization. One of the things I talk about in the paper is the kind of job implications of doing that. What would happen if we manage that in South Africa? And secondly, what it means for development globally. So sorry, that was a long introduction to lead into your question. The short answer on how we can take advantage of these trends is that we have huge amount going for us on the continent. And particularly in our position in South Africa, right? So I talk about market size in the rest of Africa, but market size is great for producers to sell products. But in this world that I'm talking about in the paper, where market size equates to a labor market, you can increasingly do service work at a global basis from right here in Africa, then it translates into a big kind of dividend in the labor market to be part of a continent with huge really oversupply in a sense of young talent. The second thing that we have in South Africa is, even though we're part of this African market, we have the strongest infrastructure base on the continent. It's a dividend that's a few decades old, and it won't last forever. We have to keep investing in our institutions and our infrastructure, but it becomes a huge advantage when it comes to doing business on the continent and tapping into some of that skill base. And then thirdly is the institutional base. And by that I mean everything from the banking system to the legal system to the our constitution. It's a very evolved and developed institutional base in South Africa. And those are our strengths that we're taking into this game. And one of the things I talk about in the paper is the gap then. If we're already so far in an advantage position in South Africa with all of these attributes, then why aren't we creating the 1.2 million jobs that the Philippines has managed to create in BPO? And there it comes down to just specific policy choices that I know we'll get to at the end around skilled immigration, around education, around changing the way the public sector works in terms of your understanding of microeconomics and, you know, the importance of cities and regions relative to countries. And then lastly, that kind of regulatory environment that makes it easier for people to move their businesses here or grow new businesses from here. So that's the kind of agenda that we now need to tackle in order to unlock all of these kind of attributes and advantages that we have in our position.
Yeah. So if we're thinking about, for instance, getting, or I guess, staying ahead or catching up, I'm not too sure where South Africa stands right now, ahead of Nigeria, you know, the Lagos and then the Nairobi folks, right? Is one of the approaches, you know, trying to figure out organizations that are looking to offshore or to outsource certain business, you know, processes and approaching them to try to get business here? Is it also in speaking with them, trying to find out the skills that they need and then creating courses to teach people? Because we know South Africa, for instance, has pretty huge unemployment problem, especially amongst the youth. Is it just revamping educational curriculum? Like, one of the things, some of the jobs, right, may not be the most difficult to start off with, but skills are important. So how do we address, you know, either skilling, reskilling, or upskilling people to be able to take on some of these opportunities, like when they do come our way or when we are able to go out and seek them? What does that look like practically, like now?
Yeah. So, look, firstly, this idea of competition between, let's say, Cape Town, Nairobi, and Lagos is a very positive thing for each of those cities and for Africa. You know, the only way we become more competitive as a continent is by competing more internally. And we need to get to the sort of position of maturity where we're okay with that, where there is competition, but it's kind of competition in the continent's interest. I don't think I think it's a very positive thing, and I think policymakers need to realize that they need to not see it as a negative. And I can tell you, Cape Town has become stronger because of competition from Nairobi and Lagos, and I would assume vice versa. Well, no, vice versa. The best way to understand what we need to do next is to work out what's already started happening around, let's take these two sectors that I deal with in the paper, which the first one is BPO, business process outsourcing, where you know, everybody's essentially competing with India and the Philippines, right? India, about 1.7 million jobs in BPO, Philippines, about 1.4 million jobs in BPO. Now, they are kind of around 30% cheaper in terms of wage rate. But we're up to now in South Africa about 250,000 jobs in the space off the back of a DTI incentive that subsidizes each job to the tune of about 140,000 to 290,000 rand a year. So basically incentives from government have got the price point to the level where we're now in the game and we can be competitive. And the question now is, as you put it, how do we build the capabilities and particularly the skills so that we can capture more of the new jobs that are going to turn into things that can be delivered remotely and already are being turned into globalized services. So the trick is to do two things, I think. The first is market the offer in South Africa. We've got some really strong institutions like KPPO and BPESA that get out there and do the sales job with the major BPO operators. But then at the same time, we need to make sure that more of our particularly young people have the sort of service ethos and the capability to sit in what is a very difficult job, sitting in a call center all day, and make sure that they're providing a world-class service that is comparable with India and the Philippines, but I think leverages our key advantages, which is things like a more neutral English accent, a great time zone with Europe for servicing sort of same time and servicing Australia or the US in terms of a nighttime service. And then a sort of natural empathy that a lot of South Africans have that comes across very strongly in a lot of our service operations. So that we need to work out how to accelerate the supply of skills that are able to leverage those attributes. But I think the point of the paper is not about saying, BPO is a source of new jobs. It's saying BPO is a source of new jobs, plus the economics that have driven the emergence of BPO is now starting to apply across all sorts of other sectors, right? So even here in Cape Town. So I mentioned 270,000 BPO jobs in South Africa, about 80,000 of those are servicing offshore work, and about half of those, so 40,000, are sitting in the Western Cape. What's interesting, just to prove how the lockdown drove this, 6,000 of those 40,000 jobs emerged in the last 2 years. So during lockdown, we added 6,000 jobs. But the BPO operators are not just doing kind of voice and text servicing of clients. There's some really interesting innovations. There's a company here called Cognia Law that is essentially outsourcing law as a service. There's a company called Ocean Rock Consulting that is outsourcing chartered accountants in South Africa as a private equity back office function. And that's just the sort of front end of this thing. The theory, the logic in the paper is that almost every business will now start having elements that can be serviced from here in South Africa. And that's essentially what's happened in technology with tech leading the way. But it's going to transform every sector, and getting those particularly skills policy and regulatory policies right is about making sure that we capture more than our share of those jobs as they move around the world.
Around the world. Excellent. Thank you so much, Tim. So, Tim, I know you are sort of a fervent advocate of, entrepreneurial activity or even like SMEs and scaling that up. What is this, from your point of view, what is the South African government, missing when it comes to supporting and advocating this group of people? I guess perhaps a better way to ask the question might be if you had the ear of, let's say, President Cyril Ramaphosa, and he wanted some counsel on supporting, entrepreneurs and the SME sector and making South Africa competitive with not only the other, even African countries, but others in the developing world when it comes to, tech ecosystems. What are the top three things or series of things that you would say to him that we absolutely need to focus on yesterday?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting example because it actually happened about 3 weeks ago. A group of people who've worked in the space for a long time ended up on a call with the president, where he was asking that exact question, and I've spent quite a bit of time working in the policy space in Parliament on these issues and in other institutions around the country. And firstly, it's really reassuring that the president is now turning his attention to this, and he said some very encouraging things around wanting to make big, bold moves in supporting entrepreneurship and particularly tech companies. So I think that's a very positive signal. What was interesting is ahead of that session, the presidency called for a lot of submissions. And almost all of them, when I looked at the list, they were kind of regulatory reforms, which means no one's asking for big new programs that are going to come with a big fiscal cost. They're really just asking for barriers to be removed. And even there were some kind of tax incentive proposals. Even those are relatively modest in terms of a projected tax loss. So basically, I said to him that the key challenge is that he needs to spend political capital to get these reforms through. Because for each of these things that the tech industry was asking for, they're kind of insiders and politically connected people whose interests are not to allow those reforms. So unfortunately, or fortunately, it's a lot of it is just sitting on his desk with him as president needing to lead the change, needing to spend the political capital to get it done. I also emphasize the kind of urgency of these reforms. At that point, I'd just been with the Harambians Entrepreneur Network in Europe, working with entrepreneurs from across the continent. And firstly, we were all sitting there realizing just how particularly Europe is back in business and COVID feels like a thing that's passed. And we urgently need to, remove the restrictions in South Africa, remove travel restrictions. We've got to get back into the game in Africa because the sort of restricted COVID environment is applying unfairly on us now, when certainly from what we saw in Europe, they're past it and they're getting back to business. But the other insight for South Africa is a lot of the momentum on the continent seemed to be coming from East and West Africa rather than Southern Africa. And that speaks to that point I made earlier about winner takes all. You know, if you've got an advantage position like having Cape Town, which is the largest tech ecosystem on the continent, then you've got to make sure you leverage that leadership position, because that winner takes all effect, if you start losing it to other places, can cost South Africa in the long run. So I said, there's an urgency to getting these things done. I basically ended by saying, I've got three simple ideas. The one is to go back to what we had around the 12J tax incentive, which was useful for crowding in these deep capital markets we have in South Africa and making sure some of that money went into early stage entrepreneurship. Mm. You know, they scrapped the incentive because there was a fear that it was being misused. But I think we need to manage the misuse rather than scrapping the entire tax incentive. Number two, everyone talks about skills and education, but we have to become stronger in skills and education. And then at the same time, we have to liberalize skilled immigration. Talented people power all of the stuff that we're talking about. And we make it too hard for them to come to South Africa. So we urgently need to make sure that the best and the brightest on the continent see South Africa as a place to build out their businesses or pursue their careers. And that's a tough thing because there's a lot of political opposition to that, but the president has to lead it because we need those talented people here and we need them urgently. Otherwise, they're going to go to other places and build those companies there. And then lastly, on the regulatory front, it just boggles the mind that we still have an exchange control regime that dates from the 1960s in South Africa. And, it makes life difficult for people transacting globally, but far more important in this conversation is that it actually provides a huge disincentive for tech companies to incorporate here, because the IP, which is the kind of main currency in a tech company, is covered by the exchange control regulation. So basically, if you want to sell your tech company and it's incorporated in South Africa, you have to apply to the Reserve Bank for approval to move that IP into the buyer's market. Now, when a venture capital fund looks at that, they just see complexity and they go to any number of other countries to try and make that deal. It's a really difficult area to understand that we haven't reformed and we urgently need to, because it's a serious constraint on actually being able to develop and hold IP in the country. Because a lot of tech companies just simply say, instead of navigating that, I'm just going to incorporate in Delaware or in the UK. And then we lose that the value add, we lose the IP, and we're kind of in a sort of second best scenario where the best we can do is have some operations and some team members here. But imagine if we were actually growing SA incorporated companies because we were transacting on an equal basis with the world's most competitive economies, because we're not trying to control capital or control IP. That's the world we need to get to quickly, and I encourage the president to be really bold on that agenda.
Yeah, no, excellent. Tim, thank you so much. And the last question before you go, right? So drawing on your experiences, or I guess the experiences you've had, the conversations you've had with others, the rooms that you've been in, what would you say is your major sort of message to a lot of young people in South Africa that are looking to play in the tech space? What are some of the experiences they should be looking out for? What are some of the skills they should be focusing on? What are some of the things that they should be doing to ensure that they are, you know, best or better positioned either to work with some of these organizations when they start, to start some of their own, or to help even influence, you know, the things happening in the tech space?
So, you know, we all talk a lot about the market potential in Africa and the demographics and the emergence of, you know, one of the world's largest population blocks. But the truth is, the reason why China, for example, has managed to turn their large population into an advantage is because you invest somewhere in China and you access the entire market. And while Africa remains 54 disconnected countries, we will never be able to leverage that market size, right? These are kind of colonial boundaries that have been reinforced by democratic governments and are kind of underpinned by what you could describe as like a generalized sort of xenophobia across the continent that is generally focused on other Africans. And you see it when you travel through the continent. There's sort of low levels of trust across borders.
Right.
And honestly, it sounds like a small thing, but I think if somebody came to me and said they were globally ambitious, wanted to work globally from Africa, which is essentially what I'm saying is the new game in our generation, the most important thing to do is to travel and understand the market in Africa, understand what we actually present as a continent, as a single market, and help to kind of break down these psychological barriers that we put up around national borders. And it translates in terms of attitude, but it also translates in terms of regulation and trading, and there's all sorts of constraints around those borders in the mind and in reality. But if you can do that, if a young person can, you know, engage globally, but from Africa, and package an African labor force and African innovation and African business idea, or even just the servicing of a global business idea from here,
the chances
are they're going to need to think beyond their national borders. So I would just encourage young Africans to get out and see the rest of their continent as the first thing. You know, cancel that trip to Europe or the USA and rather go and see something else happening in Africa, because in the end, that's going to be your competitive advantage to be able to operate and navigate across those borders, but also package our offer as something that we can sell globally. Mm-hmm. And the key message of this paper is that technology is breaking down the kind of walls that used to prevent us working in certain ways. But if we remain in these kind of national walls, with these national walls across Africa, we're never going to be able to fully engage in that new game. So partly it's about thinking more as Africans rather than in our individual countries.
Amazing. You don't hear that often, I can tell you that. But Tim, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you for the time, for doing this with me, and also sharing your experiences and leveraging, you know, all the things that you've learned over the course of your career. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Tim Harris, ladies and gentlemen. If you enjoy this chat, you will enjoy others that have come before it. Check our previous episodes on our website, www.thebrentisfoundation.org. And as always, thank you so much for listening. And guys, please share this episode with others in your network, will you? Thank you very much. Until next week, stay well.